Okay. In theory, this is being recorded. So we'll try it. Okay, so my goal is actually not to do a review, but to actually be a big office hour and ask questions, answer questions. I start by taking whatever questions I can get from the people who took the quiz. So I'll answer a few of those, then we'll just do general open questions. And I am purely audio recording this, and we'll post it as best I can. I don't have video recording pieces. So the biggest questions seem to be GANs and neural nets more generally. And I'm not quite sure what people are confused about, but we'll figure it out. So GANs, got two boxes. What's the left box? Generator, right box? Discriminator, what goes into the generator? Noise. Right? The generator takes random noise in. It produces fake signal, fake picture. What goes into the discriminator? Either a fake or a real. What comes out? Probability of being real or fake, whichever way. Right? So it's that simple. Why are these so cool and different from a normal CNN? This comes back to almost the first lecture. There's generative models and discriminative models, right? A normal CNN, discriminative, supervised, right? It gives you a label on something. And the GANs, importantly, the generator, gives you actually a example of an image taken from, as best it can, the same probability distribution as the real data, real images, right? So the generator is learning, trying to learn, a model that captures the true probability distribution across images, or whatever goes in the training set. And that's sort of cool, right? It's not going from an image to a label, it's going from nothing, random noise, to an image drawn from the distribution. That's it, pretty much. Questions? Yeah.
Can you explain the notation of D of G of Z, where Z is from the noise?
Right. So this now is, in fact, one model, right, which with two neural nets inside it. And so what's going to happen? We're going to get something coming out of it. Let's see if these. There we go. So what's coming out of this piece is the discriminator. The discriminator is a function of what comes out of the generator, right? So the output here is either a function of an image or a function of G of noise, right? Noise goes in, G of noise comes out. So G of noise goes in, D then puts some output, and it's trying to make the discriminator, it's trying to, the generator is trying to produce some signal out that's going to fool the discriminator. Okay. Does that make sense? That's so confusing.
And that's like the, with the R-min.
So the R-min is over the weights. Okay. And the generator is trying to produce fine weights that will do what? Minimize something, which is going to look like a log probability, like pretty much everything in neural net, modern neural net land is a log probability. And what is it? D, what's D putting out? It's a probability of being real, right? So D is putting out the probability of being real, and G would like to produce something such that D thinks that the thing produced is being real. So G is going to say, I'm G, I'm going to give you the image, you're D, I'm going to give you the image that you will most likely classify as real. Okay? And it's a little bit confusing, but it is, in fact, adversarial in the technical sense that one thing is trying to minimize, something else is trying to maximize. It really is adversarial, a game theoretic. G is trying to pull D, and D is trying to tell G that it's there. So the optimizations here are, when you look at them, they're sort of swapped. This wants to maximally predict real, and that wants to minimally have it predict real. Yes? Discriminative, right? Generative model takes a noise, gives you a, generates an image drawn ideally from the same distribution as the two training images. In that case, if it really could do that, it would win, right? If it could generate an image drawn from the same distribution as the training data, there's no way to tell it apart. It's managed to fool the world. It's got a deep fake that's impossible to tell apart. And the discriminator is trying to tell it apart, yeah.
What will happen if we change the random noise for the generator?
If you change the random noise?
Yeah.
So the generator is assuming the random noise comes from some distribution, and it's trained optimally for that distribution. So you need to, if you want to use a different distribution for the random noise, you'd have to retrain it. Right? It's a function from random noise, which is one distribution, to images which are drawn from a different distribution, right? So technically it's being given an instance of a random noise. You're using Gaussian noise, right? Random noise input. So it's a mapping from some point in the Gaussian noise space to some point in the image distribution space. If you gave it non-Gaussian noise, you give it 0-1 noise, it would then have a different functional form, right? You have to retrain it. Yeah.
So we were first assuming that the pattern of the noise is fixed.
The noise is generated from a fixed distribution.
Yeah.
We just code up something, again, standardly, just make every, just give it Gaussian noise from a fixed distribution. We're not learning the noise distribution. Yeah.
How do we handle
that? Overs?
Mode collapse.
We haven't covered anything resembling mode collapse. I think the only thing I want to say about this is an optimization solved by gradient descent, and because it's minimax, it has a tendency of not converging super well, so it's super easy to get stuck in bad minima. Yeah. Can we generate two different classes? So what assumptions have we made about the distribution of the images? The real images are drawn from some real world distribution, not a mathematical one, right? What assumption does this model make about the probability function that generates images? But what other weather assumptions is it making? There's some sort of, is there a modeling assumption? Or they assume it'd be Gaussian or? All we're assuming is that the generator is a complicated enough functional form to approximate reality. Does that assume that it's unimodal, got a real hump? No, it's a neural net, it's a deep net. It's got a lot of layers. It's perfectly fine if your images are drawn from a set of 1970s black and white images, and a picture of your favorite cats and dogs, and a different distribution of your friends, that's fine. That's a distribution. And this neural net, in some theory, given enough data and enough training, and a big enough net, can fit any distribution.
Two different classes in one class.
Two different
classes in one? You have in this number,
do
you
find?
If
we're putting in a bunch of images which are these are different classes, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where do the classes show up in the GAN? They really don't. The classes in some weird sense are implicit in the training data. If you looked at where the images sit in the space of all possible images is vast. And if you use 10 digits, those 10-digit images will tend to fall into 10 clusters. Make sense? But the model does not care about it. There are no labels here. This is not a discriminative model. This is a generative model. There are no labels. There's no prediction. There's no right or wrong. All it's trying to do, or what it's trying to do, what it's trying to do is to learn a function that will generate things that look just as if they had been drawn from reality. And they're frighteningly good at it.
How does the output of generator differ from the case where we directly use like generative matching networks, like directly training it for the training set instead of having a discriminator at all?
Well, how is this different from training? Well, we haven't covered generative matching, so I can't talk about that. But what else could I do? I mean, normally what I do is I take in an image and predict a label. There's no way to run it backwards. You can't run a discriminative model, here's a label, give me an image. Right? That'd be sort of cool. That's sort of, you'd like to say, give me a random number 8, an image of a number 8, drawn from the addition of all 8s. Right? There are a lot of ways you can draw 8s or 7s. I cross my 7s like a European. There are many ways to draw a 7. And the easy problem is what we did most of the semester. Given an image, is it a 7 or not? That's discriminative. The hard one says, I'm looking for a 7. Generate me one 7 that's generated with the probability of which all 7s exist in the world. And to train that, I then give it a whole bunch of 7s, and it will then generate new 7s that are drawn from roughly the same distribution that we trained it on. Does that make sense? So it's not, and then I think part of the problem is this is a really, really different way of thinking, right? We've been doing so much discriminative ones. You could train something that says, hey, you know, here are two images, are they the same thing? That's discriminative, right? Is this picture and that picture a picture of the same thing? That's a fine neural net. Put in two images, out comes some probability of being the same thing, but it's not going to generate new images. It just says, are these both images of cats, both images of dogs? Yeah?
What's the termination condition for this?
What's the termination condition?
Yeah, so when do you stop training?
When do you stop training?
Discriminating
is hard. I mean, this is just a neural net with a bunch of weights, trained by stochastic or mini-batch gradient descent. How do I decide when to stop, usually when I'm training a neural net? That's a legitimate exam question.
Test error.
I look at the outer sample error as I train more and more. The outer sample error for discrimination goes down. Now, what crap here? So normally we just train it until we start overfitting, which we almost always will start overfitting. But you're right, here we get a sort of a problem, which is there's no real test error here. What are we getting out from the discriminator? Some probability. If this thing converges successfully, what will the discriminator produce always? 0.5. Right? So if this thing works, and again, I've got to stress that this is a pretty unstable convergence procedure, so you got to be careful with the gradient descent. But if the gradient descent converges reasonably well, it converges to something pretty close to 0.5, and then you stop. Yeah?
So in general, like neural networks, here's an example where we have like a ability to converge between mean and solution, but in general, with a neural network or perhaps with like some deep learning architecture, like we're not always guaranteed to converge.
Well, let's converge to a unique solution. If I start with a different random initialization and run this thing again, will I get the same answer?
Probably not.
No, these things are incredibly non-convex models, right? Just all of these ReLUs in the modern version, or sigmoids, the old-fashioned world, intersecting, they're hopelessly non-linear, and you're never going to converge to the global optimum. And if you did converge to the global optimum, awesome.
But you're not guaranteed.
No, no. If you did, would it be good? I have infinite compute power. Your fantasy of a quantum computer, which is not reality in this case, converges to the global optimum of the neural net. Is that a win or a loss? You guaranteed overfit it, right? You do not want to find the global optimum. What do you want? You want to start with a bunch of weights that are Gaussian very close to zero, which gives you a very flat output, and you're gradually moving toward the convergence. And at some point, the weights get bigger and bigger and bigger. At some point, you stop before they get as big as they could. We've shrunk the weights by using gradient descent partially converged. The global optimum would be horrible. You'd have fit the data perfectly. That's pointless. Because again, I often have 10 million parameters and say 1 million training points. It's not uncommon to have 10 times as many parameters as observations. This is obviously looking for a disaster unless you regularize it. Good with GANs? They're sort of weird. I mean, it's a weird thing to get your head around, and they're very different. Again, yeah.
Sorry, I was just gonna say that the trained model for a GAN is the discriminator, right?
The trained model, am I interested in the discriminator at the end of the day, or the generator, usually? Most people want the generator. The generator is something that, given random noise, will give you new faces. So you want to generate faces for your gaming system. You want photorealistic faces, an infinite number of them to populate your movie. You generate this. You want to generate a vast number of clothing. Train this on a whole bunch of clothes. It will then generate different random noise. A new random number will give you a new article of clothing. So this is an awesome way to generate an infinite number of people's heads or shirts or anything that you have data to train on. So the generative part's the important part. Now the discriminative one could be used in theory to try and detect a deep fake. In practice, that's not going to work super well because the generators learn to make it be 0.5, right? When it converges, it will converge to a probability of 0.5. The generator will fool the discriminator.
So
at convergence, yeah.
So machine learning, like very, very big picture, regression problems, classification problems, and this is like the third type of problem,
right? So far in this course, we've really talked about supervised learning, right? Learning discriminatively. We'll later do unsupervised one after break. We'll do reinforcement learning later. This is a generative modeling. That's a whole different kind of modeling. It's closer in flavor to an unsupervised model, right? Why is it unsupervised? Supervised has a why. Where's the why in this one? There's no why here. It's trying to fit a probability distribution in it, which is unsupervised. It's fitting the probability of density function. So it's not, or producing a version of it, the predictive probability. So this is an unsupervised learning.
So the generator is trying to fit the probability distribution.
The generator is trying to approximate the true probability distribution over the training rule, which has no labels, yeah.
So if your goal is to try to generate real looking images,
yeah.
Then how is making the discriminator think that an image is 0.5 real and 0.5 fake? How is that producing the most realistic image?
How is that producing? How does it make the most? Why is the discriminator going to converge to 0.5? What if the discriminator were able to do better than chance? It says that looks like a fake image, that looks like a real image, at least better than chance. Is that a perfect fake? No, a perfect fake by definition is one that you're unable to distinguish from a real, right? Yep.
Typically, what are the architectures of the generative and discriminator?
Usually these are used on images, and usually they're standard CNNs. So it's a CNN just like the CNNs we covered in class.
For both the generator and the discriminator?
Yes, because both of them, yes. That's the right answer. Discriminator, obviously, taking an image, of course you want a CNN. Generator's not so obvious. But in general, these people try these in other things like language. Flaky, hard to get, really hard to get converged. But they work quite really well in images with CNNs, yeah.
Why do you call it unsupervised? Like, you are using the output, like the probability of discriminator saying it's true as a supervised.
What's the why am I saying it's not supervised? Where is the why?
Like, can't you use the output of discriminator as your why? Like, you are using.
But it's not. Let's think of this in mathematical terms. One part of the world says y is equal to some function of x, and you're going to give me a bunch of y's and a bunch of x's. That's what we've done almost all semester. A different part of the world says there's some f of x. There's no y's. The input. Where's the y? Everything we've done takes in, here's an x, here's a label for that x. That's supervised. Where's the label that I input here? You can say, okay, it's real versus fake. It's not discriminative in the classic sense. So sure, in some mathematical sort of sense, the discriminator is supervised. You tell it what the right answer is. It's either real or fake. So from a mathematical sense, I'd say yes, discriminator is supervised. It's like any other neural net. It predicts either a probability. It's not a 0 or 1. It's not an L2 loss. It's a probability loss. But yes, the discriminator is supervised in the mathematical sense. But in the machine learning sense, there's no why that's given to it in the sense that you don't have a separate label. You're not trying to say, is it a 9 or an 8 or a 4 or a 7, which is a normal supervised. Yeah. Yes, you want the distributor the discriminator wants to make the real images be labeled 1 and the fake be labeled 0. The discriminator wants to get it right, and the generator wants it to get it wrong.
If we are able to fool the discriminator,
If we have a good discriminator,
it should like detect fake as a real image.
It should detect fake as a real. It should call the fake ones real, but
yeah, like good as in like we want the discriminator. We want to fool the discriminator.
The generator wants to fool the discriminator.
So
but the best that they did, that if you look at where this converges to, the best the generator could possibly do under a reasonable learning discriminator is to get it so the discriminator has no idea. And that's why it converges to 0.5. So that is, in fact, the mini-max solution. That is the best the discriminator can do to confuse it, is to make it 0.5. There's no way for a discriminator to have things that look more real than a real and get a higher probability that won't actually work in the convergence. Yeah?
Can you go over the duality of SVMs?
Can I go over the duality of SVMs? Sure, let me put that up here. I'm going to cover a couple more things that people have asked questions about. I'm going to actually move on for 20 minutes. I think that's more than GANs, as much as they deserve. Let me think what else. The other piece, there were a lot of questions about CNNs, which is pretty basic, and I'm not quite sure what was confusing about them.
What if in the max Boolean step, the stride and the padding is set up in a way that
Yeah, so in general, what you want to do is more or less set up, and we usually in the homework assignment set things up that as you walk through with your stride, you'll exactly always fit things.
So, I mean, one of the first questions
that wasn't the case, then it's crappy and you got to fudge it, and that was a mistake on the quiz question. If it was done that way, I wouldn't worry too much about it. So, I think the answer is assume that we just pick the window and the stride such that things fit in. And the answer is, if it's not fitting in, what do you do empirically? There's one thing to tune if you want a window that doesn't quite fit in your actual image. Padding. So the answer is, fudge the padding so that things work out okay. And if we fail to do that, then we messed up. The quizzes, I apologize, I've been studying these bad and said my wrong answers. I think I've gone through and I've certainly fixed all the ones that people posted on Piazza. Yes? So let's think again. I think this is maybe the piece that's confusing. Let's first do with a black and white image. We've got some sort of image here. We've got some filter. We're going to put a filter with a whole bunch of weights. Multiply it here. We'll move it over a few times. Boom, boom, boom. If we've applied the filter, say, 9 times, how many hidden layers do we have?
9.
Right? Now we typically will have not one filter, but 1,000 filters. If we have 1,000 filters, how many hidden layers? Each filter on 9 places? 9,000. Yes?
When you're doing the actual multiplication, you're doing a matrix multiplication.
It's a matrix multiplication. What do you have? You have a filter here. You've got some x here, right? x11, x12, x13, x21, x22. And we got some filter, which is some w. And we're going to take w times x, or x times w, right? That's going to give me my number, which is the output of the filter for this window here, right? Then we move it over, and we got some other x's. x13, x14, x15, x23, and so forth. Multiply that by w, get the other output. Yeah?
Sorry, is it a matrix multiplication, or is it a dot product?
Is it a matrix multiplication, or is it a dot product? So what, good point. What is it if I have some x here, and I have some w here? What am I getting out? Is it a scalar or a matrix?
It's
going to
be a matrix,
right? The one from here is a x times w here is giving me out a scalar.
Oh,
right? It's giving me a total activation. So it's not really a matrix multiplication in the sense it's not what you think of as a matrix multiplication. It's taking the summation over If this is I and J, summation over I and J of X sub I, J, W sub I, J. Right? So it's a dot product. So matrix multiplication is sloppy on my part. Good clarification. Okay, one more twist. Most modern images are not two-dimensional with an X and Y coordinate. Most modern images are three-dimensional. They have a third dimension, which is usually called RGB, or some version of three colors. So this thing actually has depth to it. So it goes back three. Now what we're going to do is we're going to make our matrix W here now be what technically be called a tensor, which is to say it's this width by three. And now when we take the dot product of this tensor, X, right, which is across here, down here, and back there. By tensor, I just mean a three-dimensional matrix, three dimensions here. I take that with the W. Instead of summing just over I and J, I'm also going to sum over the RGB. So there's a color, a third subscript. So now I have some summation that this is a 5x5 patch, or 5x5 filter, or 5x5 convolutional structure. It's 5x5x3. I then sum up 5 times 5 times 3 x's times their w's and get the output. Yeah?
Typically for a 5x5x3 little block
yep.
in the image, do you get a single value?
You get a single value at each location. Single value here.
You do not
generally get three values, no. You do not cover the R and the G and the B separately. You normally get a single value out from that 5x5x3. Yes?
You said they do point-separable convolutions.
As that said, correctly pointed out, everything you can think of people do, so people will often, in fact, have separate ones from each of them. They'll have all sorts of different ones. So anything you can think of, someone has done it. So yes. I've way oversimplified. We will be clear in this class what you're doing, but this class in general, we're going to use the old-fashioned ones. Which one they'll be using in 2 years, I don't know. Yeah.
Because just to confirm,
yep.
when we're saying like, oh, our input volume has, you know, dimensionality for three channels, and we say we're going to convolve this with 16 filters, each filter has the dimensionality of the input, so that the output is the number of filters. That's what you were saying. Like, if my input is 5x5x3, every filter I convolve with is, you know,
one number out.
Something by three, so that it gives a scalar when you convolve.
Yeah, so each filter, the filters are always going to give a scalar.
Yeah.
And although you could have a separate filter for R and a separate filter for G and a separate filter for B if you wanted, that's a fine thing to do. In general, we'll tell you, but general will say, hey, it's a 5x5x3 filter.
Yeah.
That would be a single filter.
Yeah.
Right? And again, you can do whichever structure you want. They're all fine. Do you think that all the colors are deeply connected? Do you think they're capturing somewhat different things? I don't care. Yeah.
I mean, isn't it like more general to have the filter like take the RGB at the same time, right? Because if it is better to take them separately, right? If it's better for each one, then wouldn't like would wait to learn that way in the filter?
And in fact, often if you look at the filters that they hold one, you'll see there are some filters that are red detectors, some filters that are green detectors. Arguably, they're wasting a little bit of statistical power because you could have had just a single one of the red space with a third as many weights on it. I really don't want to get sucked into what the deep learning people do, which is they spend years futzing around with different subtlety variations on the architecture. Do you think that the colors are separate channels or combined? They're both going to work reasonably well. And which one works better depends on all sorts of things about what kind of data you have and what your convergence rate is and how much you can afford to put on the on-chip memory of your GPU and lots of things I don't care about. So I think the important thing to know is, like many other things, that today everybody uses ReLUs. 5 years ago people used sigmoidal functions. 5 years from now, I wouldn't put it up. Maybe ReLU, but who knows? The important thing is some nonlinear function that you can put things in. So I think the big picture is incredibly stable. The small details of what the structure looks like varies a lot from year to year. Yeah?
So the dimensions of
surface, the number of hidden layers depends upon actually three things. One is the size of the filter. The second is the stride. And the third thing?
Padding,
of course, yeah. And one more thing about how many hidden layers. We're missing another big choice. Number of filters, right? So a given filter is a single set of weights, which produces a whole bunch of different outputs, each going to a separate hidden layer. Hidden node, I'm sorry. But we're typically going to have hundreds or thousands of filters, right? So it's not just one filter. If you look at the pictures that I've shown, often there are maybe 50 different filters. And some filters are doing edge detection this way, and some filters are doing edge detection that way, some filters are doing red versus green detection, and some filters are doing pattern detection, is it textured versus smooth? So there's a whole bunch of filters, you know, at a minimum dozens, at a maximum often hundreds of filters in a given layer, right? So that you're gonna apply not just one weight matrix or one weight tensor, but 100 of them, right? So your number of hidden units is in fact going to be equal to the number of places one filter matches as you stride across times the number of different unique filters you have.
So the three factors you just mentioned not only determine the number of hidden layers, but also the dimension of each hidden layer.
Well, I said it wrong. They don't determine the number of hidden layers. They determine how many nodes are in the layer right behind us, right? Then you can repeat the process again. Once you've got, if you've got things that have strided over 60 different places, and you've got 100 filters, you've got 60 times 100, which is 6,000 hidden nodes in that layer. Now what you can do is on the next layer, you can put another convolutional layer, right? Because you've got those 60 by 100 outputs, right? And note that they have the same structure. There's a physical proximity. This filter moved here to this filter, moved to this one, they're nearby. So you sort of preserve the physical layout of the image, that when you move this over your 60 different locations, those have the same rough two-dimensional layout. And then I've got a third dimension, which is my 100 different filters, which is sort of a more meaningless dimension, right? So in some sense, my first hidden layer is going to be whatever, 6 by 10 by 100, or 60 by 100, and you can now do convolutions over that, right? And you do that again and again and again. Alex had, I think, like 6 of them. Modern ones often have 10 or 20. Some people love having 100 or 200, which seems overkill to me, but you know, one might argue with more neurons being good. Questions on CNNs? Yeah? Usually we're going to have the third dimension just be RGB, and we'll have it be the same. If it were a different thing, if you're doing a volumetric version, so say you're doing a brain image, which really is truly three-dimensional, now you're going to move your filter, your three-dimensional box, across X, across Y, and across Z. Right? So it's not fundamentally different, except now you have a stride in the X direction, you have a stride in the Y direction, and you have a stride in the Z direction. Is there a picture of that? Picture a box moving through space. I gotta move the box left and right and forward as well. So it's the same idea, but now I've got three dimensions to walk over. But the math all looks very much the same. Cool, I'm gonna go on to one more pre-question, and then I'm gonna turn back to the SVM duality question. Information theory, So that's worth, we've covered a bunch of these pieces at various points in the class. And first question is, what one way to think about things is our expected values. The expected value of something is what in discrete space? It's the summation over each of the possible labels or outcomes of the probability of it times the thing. Right? So what is entropy? I mean, you can have it on your cheat sheet, but you should actually know it. Minus summation of labels of P log P. P log P. Sorry, my handwriting's illegible, so I never write in word. So it's the expected value of the log of the probability. Of Z, sorry, negative. Right? And entropy is measured in what units, usually? Bits. Right? It is the unit of measure of information.
Is it not Shannon?
Is it not Shannon entropy? Yes. So the fancy name for this kind of entropy is Shannon entropy. But in this course and in general in the modern math world, when we say entropy, we mean Shannon entropy. So yes, we can credit Claude Shannon for it, but it's now just called entropy. We don't use his name anymore. But yeah, he's the guy. This is Shannon entropy. But nobody uses any other entropy, really. Cool. So that's entropy. High entropy means you're pretty sure about what the label I is, or pretty unsure. High entropy,
unsure,
right? High entropy is ignorant. Okay, KL divergence is an expected value of something. What is KL divergence the expected value of? It's also going to be the minus summation over I of P of I. That's an expected value of something. Log of
Q
over P. Can I get the sign right with the minus there? So it's the expected value of the ratio of the probabilities. Or if you will, you could equally well write it as the expected value of log of Q minus log of P. If that makes you feel different, it's the difference of the log probability, expected value. That's sort of more intuitive than the ratio, but it's the same thing. Who cares? Note the asymmetry. Usually what you're doing is you've got some true measure, or at least a more accurate measure, and one that you're using as an approximation. Which is the true one? P or Q? P. The expectation is over the true probability, and you're approximating Q as a different distribution. I don't know how similar is Q to P. But the true distribution is P, so it's the expectation over truth. Cool.
Would this be written as KL divergence of P and Q? Or
this is always written as KL of P and usually double bar Q. So you should write this. This is a good cheat sheet thing if you're not sure, but this is, it's always P, the truth first, and then when this being approximate. Right? This is used in a couple of different places. One might be that as you gain more information, if you know more about something, you could ask how well does something become closer to the true distribution. So you might use Q using one information so far, and P using some additional information. Right? I'm going to ask a question. And I'm going to ask, if I ask that question, how different is Q after I get that piece of information, that same piece here, versus before I get that information? We call that, divergence or small? It's information gain, and we want it to be big or small. Big! You want to ask a question that changes your belief about the probability. Note the asymmetry. P is after you know the information, Q is before you know it. Because afterwards, you should be better, or at least no worse. If you learn nothing from your question, what's the KL divergence between P and Q?
Zero.
You learned nothing. There was no information gain. That was not a useful question. Don't waste your time asking it. Yes?
What's the intuition behind log Q over P?
Well, I think the way is that, let me rephrase it. What's the intuition between log of Q minus log of P? Which says, how different are these two probabilities? We measure probabilities in log probability always. Turns out to be the right sort of units. And Shannon was really clever to figure that out. Before him, people didn't always do that. L2 norm is a stupid norm for probabilities. This gives you bits, and we're not going to cover it too much, but I think the idea is that information is in sort of log of probability. If you think about most of our neural nets, what are we optimizing? We're trying to get the highest possible log probability of the true label, right? That empirically is a great loss function. Looks very much like this. I want the true label to be correct. In this case, I want the estimated probability to be close to the actual probability. And closeness is well measured in log probability. That's sort of a short answer. I'm not going to give the longer one, which involves coding theory. Cool. I think I actually included some notes from the slides. So KL divergence, which you can either write as here's KL, I wrote as D sub KL, or D, right? The divergence, it's the same formula I have there. One other way to watch it is it's the cross entropy, which is to say the entropy of Q under P's distribution. It's a weird thing. Don't worry about that one. Minus actual entropy, which you should know, which is P log P. Or, in a different slide from the lecture notes, if you have some X and you learn some new X prime, how much does it tell you about some theta, like the label for your decision tree? And you could ask, how different is my probability distribution P over my labels? The Y is that I'm trying to do after I learned X prime versus before, and that is information gain. So these are all really, really similarly closely measured, right? And the thing that shows up from everywhere, from KL divergence to modern deep learning systems, is you want the log probability to either close to the real log probability, or you want the log probability of the true answer to be high. And you can say, oh, I can make the probability high as well. Sure, it's monotonic, but the log probabilities are prettier. They work nicer, both theoretically, giving you bits, and empirically, giving you clean math, and in practice on the neural nets, giving you things that work out and converge nicely. Cool. I think that's all I want to say about that. Questions? Are we going to problem on entropy? Duals! Let's do SVMs and duals. Yes?
Didn't you say we don't need to know Lagrange multipliers for SVMs?
We do not need to know Lagrange multipliers. We did not cover them this year. All you need to know is that there's sort of a duality. There's a piece which says that you often have a hard constraint, and you can put it into the penalty function. Right, so let's just do Lagrange multipliers at the level of this course. We want something which is often an arg min of some function of x, which depends on how on w, some loss function. And we might have some constraint that says that, for example, the weights are non-negative. We haven't done this course, but you might want non-negative weights in your linear regression. And one way to do that is to say, take this weight greater than zero and make it weight minus zero. Instead of saying, I want the weights to be greater than or equal to zero, I could have that saying, I'm going to pour that in and multiply it by a lambda and have a penalty. So one version is a hard constraint. The weights must be non-zero. Right? Must be positive. You can have no negative weight permitted. A different version would be I have a soft constraint, which is lambda times the something which is, well, what would it look like? In this case, I want them to be non-negative. If there's a weight, the more negative they are, the higher the weight, the penalty. And if they're positive, there's no constraint at all. What sort of a loss function does that feel like? Again, I say it again. This constraint for weights, sometimes over here says, if the weights are greater than zero, no penalty. If they're less than zero, it'll be linear in how much less than zero they are. That's a hinge sort of loss, right? That's a hinge loss starting at zero. I can take what was a hard constraint, put it in here with a weighting parameter, which is how important is that constraint? If lambda goes to infinity, the constraint will become hard. I really, really, really have to have them non-negative. And if lambda is smaller, it's a soft constraint. Yep. Sorry. So that's the Lagrange multipliers in one short lecture. Yeah.
Was this just an example, or you are actually saying for SVMs we have W greater than V?
Just an example, SDMs do not have W greater than 0. This is a different sort of constraint you might want. You could do a non-negative regression, we've not covered it, but that's a perfectly legitimate thing. Or I could say penalize the weights the more negative they get. I don't want negative weights in this world. Because often you can't ship negative quantities of goods, and so you'd like all of your things to be positive, for example. Yeah?
Can you, so two things. Is that the extent to which we need to know duality for SVM?
So let's go about duality. There is an important duality piece. And that one I think I do want to cover, and that is sort of difficult and sort of cool. In the most of this course, we worked in the predictor space. And we say, for example, that weights are equal to x transpose x. Inverse x transpose y. Maybe with a lambda I there. This matrix here, x transpose x, is what dimension? P by P. W is what dimension? P. We're in the P space. We're in the predictor space. That's the normal space we sit in. There is, however, in very common in SVMs, to work in a dual of this space, which is going to be a n by n space. And the easiest way to look at that space is I can compute x, x transpose. Dimension of that? N by n. Cool. The particular matrix we have that's an n by n matrix that we talked about? Kernel matrix. This is a kernel matrix with a linear kernel. The kernel matrix is an n by n matrix. It's the similarity of all endpoints against all endpoints. That's the kernel matrix. The similarity of the kernel, yes? Sorry? How is that the dual? I'm defining that as the dual. I'm saying that the primal sits in the P space, and the dual sits in the N space. And it's going to be the case by some magical Lagrange multipliers that we're not going to cover, that you can take a problem in the primal space and flip it to the blue dual space. It flips it N to P, it flips it min to max. There's all sorts of math that I'm waving my hands about. But the cool thing in the dual space is that when you solve it, you get something that now has some alpha, which is a dimension n instead of weights. And at the end of the day, skipping all the math because we have too much math in life, can't have too much math, I know. We can say that the weights that solve the primal problem are equal to the summation I goes from 1 to n, because we're in the dual space, of the weights alpha I in the dual space times the label y sub I, which is plus 1 or minus 1, times the training vector x. This is a representation that relates the primal, the weights in the W space, to a set of weights in the dual space. Right? Alpha is dimension n, obviously, here. And how do we find alpha? It's just some quadratic program. It's convex, you solve it. Don't worry about it. It's constant. Yeah.
So we've seen like kernels like that show similarity of x and y.
Yeah.
And your kernel would be like x transpose y.
Right.
Can you explain that? And then there's this kernel for x, x transpose. I'm having trouble.
Yes. So what is a kernel function? Let's digress and we'll come back and do that. We haven't quite finished that. But let's take a kernel function. A kernel function is some function that takes in two points. Call them x1 and x2. They're each p-dimensional things. And it returns, well, what properties is it? What is it actually in English returning? It's a similarity. And what sort of properties does it have? It's non-negative or positive semi-definite, which is the same sort of thing, right? It only gives non-negative stuff out, right? Can't have a negative thing there. So positive semi-definite is sort of the matrix version or the function version of non-negative. And it's positive semi-definite and symmetric, right? So symmetric similarity function. That's pretty much the ones that matter. So what does it take? We did a couple of ways to measure how similar things are. The most common kernel function, what's the one that's most widely used? The Gaussian kernel function. We don't worry about the normalization, it's not a probability, but we can say, hey, how similar
is x1 and x2. Let's take their L2 norm, negative over some constant. That is the most widely used kernel. Well, except maybe the linear kernel. What's the linear kernel? X1 transpose X2, the dot product.
Oh, for all, I and X1 and J.
Well, no, let's be careful. There's two different things that sound similar in there. One is the kernel function.
Yeah.
It takes in two vectors and gives you a scalar.
Yeah.
And the other is, if you take in some matrix X, which is N by P, to get the kernel matrix, we're going to take all the pairs, every I and every J, that's N squared things, and we're going to find the kernel function. So the elements, K, I, J, of the kernel function, K, I, J, which is the ith row, J column, the kernel function, kernel matrix, is the kernel function of X of I, X of J. Right? So the kernel function takes in just two vectors of the same size and returns a similarity. The kernel matrix is all pairs of similarities. Yep.
So if the linear kernel is X, or the linear kernel matrix is X transpose X, how does that work? Because you can have a non-negative result with a dot product.
Ah, so yeah. So here's the weird thing, and I've been maybe sloppy in saying it. Is it the case that the kernel function of two vectors must be non-negative? No, you can have a negative piece here. It's fine to have the dot product be negative. The kernel function can return negative things. However, it needs to be positive semi-definite. Now, I didn't want to define a positive semi-definite function, which was more math I wanted to do. So instead, I said if you plug in any matrix X that's n by p, we'll get out a kernel matrix that's n by n. And my definition of a positive semi-definite matrix is easy. Compute the eigenvalues. Are they all non-negative? Right? So we're going to cover eigenvalues a lot in this course. So I feel perfectly comfortable saying, hey, this matrix, this outer product, or this kernel matrix, must always have, in a second, must always have non-negative eigenvalues. That's a piece of math that you're supposed to know. And I'm happy to say that's what positive semi-definite means, non-negative eigenvalues. Or if you will, positive definite means all positive eigenvalues. And so we can then say that the kernel function is something that no matter what X you plug in, any X you plug in, any matrix, giving all the n pairwise functions, dot products, these guys, and plug it in and just go, oh, magically, it'll be the case, if it is a kernel function, that the kernel matrix is positive semi-definite.
Got it.
Question?
So you're saying that's a kernel matrix, which means by that definition, the ith row of the jth column has the kernel?
Yep.
Between the ith vector and the jth vector?
Yep.
What's the kernel? What's the kernel function?
Well, there are several kernel functions. Here's one kernel function.
So you're just transposing the two vectors.
Take one transpose, take the dot product. So one kernel function called the linear kernel is the dot product. That's one kernel function you should know. The other one, and it's the only two we're ever going to use in this course, the other kernel function says take the L2 distance between the two vectors, square it, and take minus that over some constant. The constant is called what?
Vector.
Kernel width, be the fancy word. And this particular kernel has a name that we've seen in other places in this course. It's a radial basis function. Right? So the radial basis function, we take the similarity between each point and some mu, the center of that basis function. But that's using the same basis function or kernel function, which is the Gaussian kernel. And again, it's radial because all the dimensions of X, all p dimensions, are equally important. It's spherical. If you say, how far away is this from that? The distance goes out in L2 space, which gives you a circle of equidistant points, or equisimilar points, once you put it through e to the minus.
What are the properties of kernel function?
What are the properties of the kernel function? It is symmetric. It is guaranteed that if you plug in any matrix X, right? Any set of n points of size, each with size of those X, that what comes out will be a kernel matrix that's positive semi-definite.
The kernel, like the kernel function, not the kernel matrix, like not the capital one, the small one.
Yeah.
That can be like negative as well, right?
It could be, it can be negative. Sure, X dotted into to X, two X's could have a negative dot product. You can have a positive semi-definite matrix that has negative entries in it. You can have a positive semi-definite kernel that sometimes gives negative values. So negative in matrix land is not quite the same as negative in scalar land. Negative in matrix land only cares about the eigenvalues. If you have one or more negative eigenvalues, it's sort of a negative-ish matrix, right? If all of the eigenvalues are zero or greater, it's a non-negative matrix or a positive semi-definite matrix. So with Keter matrices carefully, but when you're thinking in matrices, think in eigenvalue space. Yes?
So one quiz question asked about radial-based functions.
Yes.
And what would be the best C to pick under a certain condition? One of them was when X, the minimum distance between two vectors was certain.
Yeah. I remember that one. So let's look at some example. Here's x1, here's x2. There's about a bunch of points in my x1, x2 space. That's all I can draw. I can do some different radial basis functions. Here's one where I've got radial basis functions, three of them that look like that. C big or small? Big. Good? Not good. It's crappy. These things are all over the place. Here's a different set of radial basis functions. See? Big or small? Very small compared to how far away the points are from each other. Good?
Yeah.
Nah, I want sort of radial basis functions that look sort of yay big. I want them to capture a reasonable number of points, such that any one point is sort of a bit in a couple of them. But so that's the answer to that question is C controls how big they are, which is how much regularization there is. If C is big, is this heavily regularized or not? If C is big, is this going to give a high variance or low variance estimate? I hear a few, it's low variance. If C is big, you're pretty much taking the average. The average is really heavily regularized.
Can you explain
that more? Yes, think about what it looks like for a radial basis function. If the radial basis, in my points again, if I have a radial basis function like this, then how far apart are all points? They're all, how to put it? What does this function look like if C gets big? C goes to infinity, this is giving you e to the minus 1 over infinity, it's always 1. It's really flat. It's stable. It says the answer is always 1. Every point's equally important. They're all equally close to each other. It's just 1. So if you have a radial basis function that's humongous, what you're going to do is say every point counts equally in my model, and I just average them all together. It's like k nearest neighbors with every point being one of the neighbors. It just smooths everything away. Right? So if you have a big Gaussian, you're averaging a lot of stuff within that Gaussian. As the Gaussian gets smaller and smaller and smaller, you're going to have fewer and fewer points in it, and it'll be much more high variance. Right? To say, if I have radial basis functions where each one is just basically one point, now it's going to basically say, hey, when I go to make a prediction, what's the most close point? Take its y value. High variance, low variance? High variance, right? Whatever point I happen to land on, it's maybe noisy. I pick the y for that one point. It's going to be a very unsmooth function. Yeah?
Can you explain the input and the output of a kernel basis, a radial basis function?
Yes, so what's the input? Great question. What's input? What's output? Radial basis function? we're going to have some place where we have y is some function of x for linear regression. In particular, we're going to say that y is equal to the summation of k, say it goes from 1 to big K, of some weights, I call them w sub k, of some basis functions, phi of x and mu sub k. So what am I saying? I'm saying effectively, when I predict my y, I want to have it at a given x. I'm going to compute how similar this x is, how close it is to each of the k centers of my basis functions, right? And implicit inside here really is a c, of course, right? That's another parameter, so it's x with some mu k and c. And for each of my k basis functions, I've used the same phi because they're all this equation, just looks like x minus mu squared distance divided by c. It says, find how similar x is to every mu, which are my center of my k different radial basis functions. Take that similarity in each of those k cases and multiply them by a weight. Yeah?
What are the dimensions of weight x and mu?
What's the dimension of w here? N times 1? P times 1? Let's be careful. So y is a scalar. That's just a number we're predicting. Right? It's like a regression. We could have written, instead of y equal f of x, we could have written y is equal to w transpose x. Sorry, I can't really read that, but w transpose x. W here would be dimension p. X is dimension p, right? So that's one version of the original one. But these w's, maybe I should call them something different. How many of them are there? K of them, right? I've taken what was a p-dimensional problem and converted it into a k-dimensional problem, right? So there are k centers of my clusters. That gives me k basis functions. That means every point x maps from a p-dimensional space to a k space. Wow, that was fun. Right? Almost feels like a dual, but we'll say it's not. Call it that. But it's changed from the original x space, which is dimension p, to a new set of k different similarities. So I'm mapping. Let's try and do it in a picture. Say we have mu1 here and mu2 here, right? I have some point x. I put x here, what does it look like? It looks like, first of all, what dimension? Well, in fact, let's do a three mu's. Mu1, mu2, and mu3. There we go. I've got three centroids. If I take an x over here, it's the new space will be k will be what? Three here, right? And the new space, phi1, phi2, phi3, phi1 is equal to small number, very close to that. Phi2 and phi3 values of x, bigger. If I take an x right here, it looks like three equal numbers. It's equally close to all three of them. If I take a point over here, it's a bigger component 1, bigger 2, and a smaller 3. I take a point way over here. They're all going to be small, right? If I have a point x way out here, and I've got my c's are like this big, the distance of x to mu1 or mu2, mu3 is big. That's the distance here. If the distance is big compared to c, the kernel width, then the whole thing is here going to be small, and in fact, sort of exponentially small, to be precise. So if the point is really far away from everything, then all three of my basis function values is going to be small. Make sense? But with anything that's sort of reasonably around here, if it's close to here, we'll put a, we'll be close to this, similar to this, that'll be big, and then it'll be smaller, and vice versa. So it's a way of measuring how close I am to each of these pieces, and then these weights that are learned will look something that tells me something about what the y looks like here versus there. Yeah. W sub k here is a scalar.
And then phi is actually spits out a scalar.
And phi fits out, a kernel function, fits out a scalar.
So it takes in the two vectors, x and
mu. It takes in the vector x and mu.
Which are actually in the dimensions of, in that case, it would just be the Cartesian grid. So like
in that case, yeah. So this, these are each, x and mu are dimension p. They're in the original space, right? A primal, if you want to be fancy. The original space is dimension p, I've got an x, I've got a centroid or a point in that space, and it says how similar is x to this prototype or center, or, now center is a good word for it, the center of this Gaussian, right? So it measures similarity of x to each of the centers of these basis functions.
And then c is a scalar.
And then c is a scalar, which sets the scale of what does it mean to be far away, right? This is the square distance up here, right? And the distance squared, it's got to be in some units in some sense, and C says, how far is far? Yes?
Can we go over multinomial logistic regression next?
Go over multinomial, yeah, well, yes, but we need to sort of go back. I think we haven't quite finished this. So let me go back and finish SVMs.
How can we use RBS to reduce dimensionality?
How can we use RBS to reduce dimensionality?
To increase dimensionality.
How can we use RBS to increase? In the case which I just showed you, where'd it go? The original dimension is what?
Two.
The transformed dimension, k, is mentioned. Three, I just increased the dimensionality. I have a two-dimensional x in, I've got three dimensions of u coming out. I increased the dimensionality. Yep.
So is the radial basis function just a fancy name for a kernel function that's being used in this?
The radial basis function is the radial basis function just a fancy name for the kernel being used here? Yes and no, but it's a very particular kernel. There's only one kernel which is a radial basis function. That's the Gaussian kernel. So a radial basis function is the name for the Gaussian kernel. There are lots of other kernels, including the linear kernel, which is not a radial basis function. Yep?
Is it not a kernel since a kernel takes two inputs and an RBF just takes one?
There's a kernel function which takes in two inputs, in this case, x and mu. So the kernel function, the Gaussian kernel, takes in x, which is a point, and mu, which is a center, and returns a similarity. So the radial basis function is defined by the kernel similarity of a point and a centroid.
But in itself is not a kernel.
Pardon?
The RBF itself?
The RBF itself is not a kernel anymore, no. It's generated using a kernel. Once you got the phi here, the phi, once you have these parameters, is just a function of x. So the basis function is a function of x with some parameters. So you're correct. The basis function, its signature, takes in an x. The rest are just parameters. So it's not a kernel function. But note that the basis function was derived by plugging in mu as one of the points in the kernel function. So I use a kernel function to derive the basis function. Yeah?
Why is
Why am I summing them up? So phi is telling me how similar my point x is to each of these three points. If, say, my x is right here, what do I want in terms of predicting? I've got some y over here, and some y over there, and some y over here. If I've got an x here, what do I want to make the y's look like? If I were doing a kernel regression sort of thing, or a nearest neighbor sort of thing, I want to weight the prediction here as being more heavily weighted with sort of what the y is over on this side, and less heavily with the y here or there, but some weight still. But rather than plugging the y's in like a kernel regression, what I'm doing is fitting a w that will do that. So these w's used will learn that if you're close to a kernel basis function, you should have a y similar, and if you're far away, you should have less effect. Yep?
If I'm not wrong, this is like a special case.
I think think it's similar to, I have to think about that. I'm not sure it's identical to kernel rejection.
And in that case, it's like summation of y I into the kernel function and not w.
That's the difference. The yeah. By the way, feel free to leave at any point. I will end things by 4:30. But yes, good to leave. So there is a difference between something which is plug in a bunch of y's and do a weighted combination, just using the y's versus using it does a regression. So it's not quite the same.
Like we are not using y anywhere on the right hand side. Yeah.
There's no y on the right hand side. It's only run a regression. This is a regression that takes y and regresses it on something here, which I often call z. Z is a matrix which is what dimension? I've got a y which is dimension n by 1. Z is equal to n by k. Right? There's n observations, each of size k, from the k pieces here. So I start with an x, which is n by p. I transform it to a z, which is n by k. I plug it into standard linear regression world.
Like, I don't see the relation of inputs with the outputs anywhere on the right-hand side. So how is it? Oh, the w has
it. I'm regressing, predicting y, as a function of z, using linear regression. With the weights, right? That's got my k-dimensional piece there. Let me go back, finish this. I want to move on a little bit and cover maybe one more thing. So let's go all the way back to SVMs. So SVM, we were sitting in the dual space. We said, hey, we can approximate my p-dimensional w as a summation over my n training points of something which is a dual weight alpha, which is some magic number that comes from solving an optimization, times y, which is plus 1 or minus 1, times x, which are the training points. We said in the support vector machine dual, we solve for this, and we're going to end up getting some weights that are non-negative, where these alphas are going to be something that weights each x, and it either makes it a plus 1 or minus 1, pushes it one way or the other way. And the magic thing about solving this dual, because the alphas are non-negative, sort of an L1-ish style thing for the behavior loss, most of them will be zero. Right? So it's going to turn out empirically that when we run these, almost all the alphas will be zero. There'll be a small number, right, maybe hundreds, but a small number of alphas that are non-zero. And we have a special name for the X's, which have non-zero alphas. Support vectors. Those are the support vectors. The support vectors are the vectors such that, given these support vectors, if you multiply each one by plus 1 or minus 1, depending on what the label of that point is, by some piece that came out of an optimization, a quadratic optimization, that will give you W. So you can always, mathematically, I've done the math, but using the magical advantage multipliers, you can always express W as a weighted sum of the X's with most of them being 0. Yeah.
So I know to maximize the margin, you need to basically minimize the norm of the weights.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Okay. But the actual equation for the margin itself, right, it's some linear form, but is that with like the smallest W possible or?
So I think the thing to be careful about when we do these word vectors is there's an easy case that's often done, which I didn't show the first. If the world is separable, then in fact, what you'll find is it's easy to find a hyperplane such that there's things like that, and there's 3 points in the support vectors, and the whole map is super easy. There's a margin here, there's a margin there, you've got the distance, and everything is beautiful in the separable case. In reality, there's always some annoying point over there and there. And those are also support vectors. They will influence the optimization. They have non-zero alphas. How important is this point over here that's wrong? It's weighted linearly, quadratically, exponentially, in distance from what?
Oh, it should be weighted linearly from the...
It's linearly, first of all, from this one, and that one. The margin over here, right? There's a hinge loss. It says if you're on the correct side of the margin, right? This guy has a loss of 0, this guy has a loss of 0, this guy's got a loss of 0, and as you go from this margin here,
As you move this way, the farther you are, the cost goes up linearly. Right? So this guy has a cost linear and how far he is from this margin. This guy's got a cost linear and how far he is from the other margin, because it's symmetric. So we have, in this case, how many square vectors is, okay?
Five.
Three on the margin and two that are misclassified. So it's all the marginal points plus the misclassified ones. In this world, it looks sort of crappy, but often you'll have thousands and thousands of points that are correct, and they all have zero alphas. They'll drop out, because all of these guys tell you nothing in this loss function, the hidden loss. Yeah.
Can you specify again the dimensions of each of the items in that summation?
Of this one. So, how many alphas are there? N of them, one for every observation. How many y's are there? N of them are scalars. How many x's are there? N of them, each of dimension p. What dimension is w? P, that's our original weight we had before. Yes?
To allow for like points that are on the wrong side of the margin, you have to produce like slack variables, right?
So the slack variable, so if you look at the math of where it comes in, you put a slack variable, the slack variables end up being exactly the same as the hinge loss. Mm-hmm. So yes, you can call it a slack. So instead of being a hard constraint, a hard constraint was you've got to be on the correct side of the margin.
Yeah.
In optimization terms, you have a slack variable, which is how far you are. If you will, in our terms, you have a penalty or piece of your loss function, which says how far are you away from the correct side of the margin. So yes, slack variable, hinge loss, same thing, right? Both of them give you a cost linear in how wrong you are. Yeah?
To go back to that drawing,
yeah.
So your hinge loss that you drew over there,
yeah.
For the circle.
Yeah, so the hinge loss, if this is the bar, where I've got, let's make sure I use the right way. So if this is dividing, so these are x's over here, and these are o's over here. And so this hinge loss, which says from here, it's zero if I'm over here. What's zero over here? Is the x's or the o's? X's.
Yeah.
Or zero here, and the o's go up linearly with distance away from this margin.
Okay. So your drawing should be flipped.
So it should be rotated.
The hinge loss one?
Yeah,
I don't know how.
I think you were saying, like, from the other perspective. Like, if we were to misclassify an O as an X.
Oh, I may have said it backwards. I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay.
Over here, you've got, from this side on, there's zero cost for X's. And X's, as you go this way, go up linearly from this margin. This way, the X's are getting longer.
Even if it's within the margin?
Even if it's within the margin. Yes. That's the weird thing there. This is a really weird and critical point, because this is why these are called large margin methods. They're trying to make the margin big, and if you have an x, which is right here, that x is correct in terms of classification, the 0-1 loss, zero loss. It's right, it's on the correct side of the division, but it's on the wrong side of its margin, and you will pay a penalty for it, okay? So we would like to not just have everything be correct. We want something stronger than everything being correct. We want everything being correct and being on the correct side of the margin. And that is a radical, when we first got understood, like, whoa, this is a really different kind of loss function, right? There's one thing you think you're right or you're wrong. It's how computer science is binary. It's either right or wrong, but this says, nah, even if you're right, it's not good enough. I want to have it be far away from the hyperplane, which is on the correct side of the margin. So the hinge loss sits on the margin, not on the hyperplane of the building. Yeah?
Does that also become the support vector then?
Yes, that's all support vector. It's wrong. It's not wrong in the classification level, but it's wrong in the sense it has a non-zero hinge loss.
So for the support vectors, we have like the weighted sum should be zero. Like on support vectors are on the boundary, you say, so they're W transpose explicit.
So think about the loss function. Think about the hinge loss. Anything which is correct has a hinge loss of zero. Anything which is on the margin has a hinge loss of zero.
Yeah.
And anything that has a hinge loss that's non-zero
what shows up in here, these are both the points on the margin and anything that's wrong, that's on the wrong side of the margin. Right, so the non-zero alphas, or are the x's that are support vectors, and again, I'll say it once more, support vectors are any point on the margin, which is a support vector, and any point which is on the wrong side of the margin is a support vector. Those are necessary and sufficient to give you your actual W. Yes?
Is the usage of the hinge loss already factored into the offset?
Yes, the hinge loss was used inside the optimization. So to run this, you gotta find this alpha. This alpha is found by solving an optimization problem. Yeah. That optimization problem has a loss function. If you look at the loss function, I'll write it, has a hinge loss in it.
I see.
Yes?
Why are the ones that are all on the margin necessary?
Why are they necessary? Because the optimization, if you didn't have those points, you could move the margin farther away. So you need to know where they are to know where the margin is.
So not just for the angle of the hyperplane, but also for the distance.
It determines both the location of the hyperplane. Well, it's really specified by W, right? W tells me what the hyperplane is, right? W is the thing orthogonal to the hyperplane. So W tells me the hyperplane. And to find W, I need to know all the points on the margin. And if I took away this blue point and this point in the margin here, then it would move it back and say, oh, I could put the margin over there, which would shift the hyperplane over this way. So if you remove the point of the margin, you've relaxed it, and I can move that piece over, I'll shift the hyperplane. Right? So if you take out a point on the margin, mostly it's going to tend to make the stuff move, right? Yeah.
On the similar lines, if you add a point inside the margin, wouldn't the margin shift inside? And
yep, if you put a point inside the margin, it's going to shift it to try and put it away.
And one more doubt, when you say you go to dual space, do you make the space of this chain to using a kernel and transform to a space where they are linearly separable and then solve it? Or
usually what you do is you start with your original primal problem, you then convert it to a dual space, which looks in the linear world like a XX transpose, but often in fact uses a Gaussian kernel. That will give you a kernel matrix. That kernel matrix then is given to an optimizer of the hinge loss and then solves it in fine phase. Yeah?
So in practice, in the linearly separable case that we have no witness classification, the G10 has it. It's just like, so like 2 points that have to be like support vectors on the same side. They have to be exactly on the margin, right? Like if it's even like slightly off, it's not a support vector.
If it's slightly off the margin on the correct side, it's not a support vector.
Okay, so then the gene tree have more than like one or two points on each side.
In the linearly separable world, you're going to have basically, if you're in p dimensions, you'll have at most, I think, p plus one support vectors.
Okay.
So linearly separable world, the support vector scales roughly as a dimension.
Okay.
In the real world, you got noise, and it scales as the dimension plus the noise.
Okay.
That's it. Cool. We have pretty much no time. I think I covered most of the key questions. I think people should go.
Can we go over the multinomial?
Multinomial logistic regression. Let's do one more. We can do that last one, and then I really will get out of here and let you all go. So, it is often the case that we have three or four or five different classes. And if we look at this as a two-dimensional space, we could have some labels A, and some labels B, and some labels C, and of course, Kraftman will have some labels C over there, but we'll ignore that. And we would like to learn something. If it was just A, B, we're going to run a logistic regression, which will minimize the log likelihood, which will learn some sort of hyperplane that separates A's from B's, right? Not one that maximizes the margin, one that fits all of them, and even the B over here, and the problem with logistic regression, there's the B over here, has a lot of weight. Because this is really, really unlikely to be a B, so you must be really crappy to pull the whole hyperplane over to get this wrong B. We don't use logistic regression as much as we use support vector machines often, but okay, so we got a decision there. Now we'd like to do, instead of learning something that's just a yes-no categorization, learn an ABC categorization, and you can sort of see that it should end up having something that looks sort of like a three-way split in space, like a Voronoi tessellation from our k nearest neighbors. And one way to do that, a couple of formulations, but the easiest one is you're going to have three different probabilities. A probability that it's A for a given x, a probability that it's B for a given x, and a probability that it's C for a given x. And these are going to look like logistic functions. So like if 0 is 1, and there'll be some partition coefficient, denominator, you divide by to make sure the three probabilities sum to 1. And if you look at it, you can think that there are going to be then, for each of these three probabilities, something that looks sort of like a weight sub B, and a weight sub A, and a weight sub C. So we'll end up with three weights, three vectors sitting in the P space. And once we subtract it off the constant term and dump things in the right way or put the constant term into it, what it really looks like is I've got a C, a B, and an A. Now if I want to say what is it, I will just take for any new point, I will take WB dot into A, into X, WA dot into X, and WC dot into X. Whichever one is biggest will be the label. That's because the probability function is monotonic in the score. Right, there's a score, WA times X, which is how much does X point in any direction, basically, right? And there's a score, WB, dotted in X, which is how much does X point in the B direction. And something for C, in the end, to get a probability, we're going to have to put these inside some function, right, that takes a sort of a e to the minus that divided by some constant to make it a probability. So if you want to do the probability, you got to plug in each of these into the formula, which is not too ugly, but it's got some exponents and a bunch of stuff stumbled in the bottom, so it sums to 1. If you want to find the maximum, you could just look at which of these is the biggest score. Yeah?
How is the softmax used versus a one-be-all classifier?
So, there are two different ways you could do this. You could ask the world, is it A or is it not A? That's a standard logistic regression, right? You could ask, is it B or not B? That's a standard regression. You could actually run all those entirely separately. And you could run, if you have 1,000 different categories, which is sort of moderate size for, say, images, you have 1,000 different labels, you run 1,000 different logistic regressions and say, hey, is it A, yes or no? Is it B, yes or no? Is it C, D, yes or no? That's fine for logistic regression. In general, for a neural net, rather than running 1,000 neural nets, each of which are going to then give you a probability that it's some label, that gets really expensive. You want to go to a single neural net, and what we'll have is 1,000 outputs. And each of those 1,000 outputs will be some sort of a number, a real number. We want them to be probabilities. How do we take 1,000 numbers, an x dimension 1,000, make it a 1,000 dimensional probability? We softmax it. So the softmax is a function that guarantees takes any vector, size k, and gives you out a k-dimensional distribution.
How do you reckon, so I follow him.
Yeah.
How do you follow it in the case of 1,000 separate individual logistic regressions? How do people use that?
If you did 1,000 different logistic regressions, first of all, people don't do it with 1,000, but if you did 3 different logistic regressions, now you've got probability estimate for A, for B, and for C, which are not forced to sum to 1, but it's okay. Pick the maximum if you want a label. Right? So you can pick the highest probability output and say that's it. Which is often what you do with the softmax. You've got a thousand dimensional vector. Which one is it? Right? You've got to show one image to the customer. You get one image to pick. Pick the one with the highest probability. Yeah?
Softmax spits out a vector on a skillet.
Softmax takes in, what's the signature of softmax? I'm going to take some x, some output of x, and we're going to have something which is going to give me some probability distribution over all of these. If this is a p-dimensional or k-dimensional x, it's going to give me the probability dimension k. Right? Softmax takes all 1,000 outputs of my neural net and transforms them into a 1,000-dimensional probability distribution. We are out of time. Thank you. I will see you all on Monday for something that won't be on the exam. And we will be on Piazza answering questions, and you'll be answering questions. And you'll all do awesomely. Just 1 second. I need to...